Good morning and welcome to Manzanita Voices. We have a very exciting show for you today, and I know you'll be glad that you joined us. So grab a cup of coffee and find a comfortable chair, because you really don't want to miss this program. And have a pen and paper handy for email and website addresses. You will want them today for sure. This is Linda Field, and I'm your host of the show. My guest today is award-winning crime reporter Scott Thomas Anderson, and he's here to tell us about his experiences over the last year and a half being embedded with law enforcement as they tracked down a lot of bad guys, the people who manufacture, sell, and use methamphetamines. Scott has risked his life to get this story, and he has written a book about it called Shadow People: How Meth-Driven Crime is Eating at the Heart of Rural America. It's an important book that, in my opinion, should be read by everyone, because drug abuse is one of the most serious problems we face today. We're losing our young people, and our lands are being polluted by this terrible blight. I think this show is so important that I'm going to dispense with our morning workout today, because I really want to give more time to Scott Anderson. But don't forget that I do love to read short poems and stories that you send to me by email. Your work should take about 2 minutes for me to read and should be embedded in an email to writers@kvgcradio.com. I don't want to have to open attachments, so please cut and paste your piece into the body of the email. writers@kvgcradio.com. Think Voice of the Gold Country to get the letters in the right order. Now, if you'd rather send snail mail, the station address is KVGC Radio, 1500 South Highway 49, Jackson, California, 95642. I'll try to remember to announce that at the end of the show as well. I also want to remind you that this show is sponsored by Manzanita Writers Press and the Calaveras County Arts Council, and you can check out their websites to learn about them and what's going on. These are two very active and dynamic organizations. The website for Manzanita Writers Press is www.manzapress.com. That's M-A-N-Z-A, press.com. And the Arts Council website is www.calaverasarts.org. That's C-A-L-A-V-E-R-A-S arts.org. Once again, you can contact me with questions, submissions, or comments at writers@kvgcradio.com. Okay, now I want to welcome our guest, Scott Thomas Anderson. By the way, you'll want to check out his website. It's www.scottthomasanderson.com. When you type that out, you're going to see three T's in a row, and then you've known you spelled Scott Thomas correctly. So, all that's out of the way. Now we can get to the really interesting and important story. Welcome, Scott.
Thank you.
It's really good to have you here. Your book, Shadow People. Would you please tell us why you wrote it and a little bit about what it's about?
Well, I wrote it because I've been a crime reporter in Amador and Calaveras County for going on 6 years, and that experience gave me a front row seat to an incredible amount of heartache and havoc that methamphetamine was causing in our region. And as I met other reporters from around the country, other crime reporters and other journalists, they were seeing the same thing in other rural communities that are similar to ours in different parts of the United States. Like I said, I had a front row seat to it. I had court case after court case after court case that I covered, arrest story after arrest story. So it was something that's been bothering me for a long time, having grown up in a rural area.
Did most of those people get convicted?
Well, yeah, a lot of them plead guilty. Most of it never goes to trial, but it's a log jam in the legal system. There's not a lot of place to put these individuals unless they're violent offenders, and a lot of them barely do any jail time or prison time and are right back out on the streets committing crimes again. And it's not the fault of law enforcement, and in some cases it's not the fault of prosecutors. It's the epidemic is so big and there's so many addicts committing crimes that I'm not sure anyone in the legal system knows exactly how to handle it. I've yet to have a judge give me a straight answer on what would be the best way to deal with this problem now that it's at this proportion.
Are most of these offenders male?
I would say this drug does not discriminate by gender or sex.
So a lot are female as well.
Are they all
in late teens to early 20s? Pretty much.
It is so hard to make a blanket statement about who this drug chooses to take over. I would say the majority of meth users are between 25 and 65, but certainly there are teenagers using it, and there are people over 65 using it.
Wow. That's incredible. What exactly is methamphetamine, and what does it do to the body?
Methamphetamine is an extremely powerful stimulant for the central nervous system. It was first created as a synthetic drug in 1919, but it did not become anything resembling an American drug epidemic until the late 1960s.
Hmm.
It started with two legal forms of methamphetamine that were prescribed by doctors, methadrine and dioxin. And by the time pharmaceutical companies realized what they'd unleashed on the public and started to regulate and pull those drugs back from consumers, the counterculture, specifically in the San Francisco Bay Area, had already discovered it, and it was slowly becoming a drug of choice. You know, acid was in the mix and other hallucinogenics, but methamphetamine was a completely different drug. It gave people energy. They could go 3, 4, 5 days without sleeping in some cases, and they felt like they were being productive. The men felt like they were supermen. You know, women felt like they could do a million things at once and multitask in ways they never could before. But what nobody understood who was getting into the drug at the time was how entirely insidious it is and how it binds itself to your body in such a way that you feel like you can't live without it in a lot of cases once you start using it. And so the pharmaceutical companies kind of pulled it back, but by that time you had a lot of chemistry students in college out in the Bay Area who were dropping out because of the counterculture and could cook methamphetamine.
Oh my gosh.
They began cooking in small makeshift labs. Outlaw motorcycle gangs on the California West Coast sort of took over the distribution of it, the Hells Angels specifically, or maybe the Godfather organization of selling methamphetamine. First they used dropout college students to cook it, then they started learning to cook it themselves. It has an interesting progression, though, because methamphetamine originally was cooked using the main ingredient, propanone. Propanone was a chemical that the public didn't really need. It was used for airplanes and some other industrial uses that the public didn't really know about, or it's not something people would ordinarily buy.
Uh-huh.
In 1980, the federal government thought they could end the meth epidemic, which was becoming an epidemic by 1980. So they thought they could end that by making propanone impossible to get. They essentially outlawed propanone. Almost overnight, the people who were cooking methamphetamine realized that they could use a new ingredient, which was ephedrine. And the entire paradigm around meth abuse changed, because now the main ingredient was a chemical that millions of cold and sinus sufferers across the United States need and depend on certain times of year to feel healthy and feel good. And it wasn't some chemical they could just take away from the public because it wouldn't be fair to punish millions and millions of cold and sinus sufferers for the behavior of criminals. And so that's when you saw the labs explode across the western United States. California, the lower western United States, the upper western United States, eventually into the southern states. There were meth labs all over the place. This became a problem that got worse and worse till about the year 2005, when the federal government stepped in and thought they could do something to stop the problem or slow it down. So they passed all kinds of regulations on ephedrine, how much you can buy at a time, you know, giving all kinds of personal information out when you buy it at the pharmacy. And anybody who uses ephedrine knows what I'm talking about. It's entirely different now. It's monitored who buys it, how much they buy. that didn't end the meth epidemic. It looked like it put a big dent in it for about 2 years, 2006 and 2007. It almost looked like the federal government had seceded and you know, winning some kind of victory. But by 2008, the crime numbers, the abuse numbers had jumped right back up to where they were. And now in 2011, they're worse, according to most experts, than they've ever been. And that is because Mexican drug cartels below the border, which are already supplying the United States with its heroin, cocaine, and crack, and, you know, large-scale marijuana, simply took over the methamphetamine trade and have had no problem having super labs in Mexico where they cook mountains of methamphetamine and then run it up, you know, run it up corridors through California, through Arizona, through Texas, through Georgia. And so traditional meth dealers are now, for the most part, getting their methamphetamine from Mexican nationals and then selling it as middlemen. And, you know, the Drug Enforcement Agency says that 80% of methamphetamine in America now comes from Mexico, with the other 20% being small makeshift meth labs in the United States where people are managing to get enough ephedrine to cook it by doing what's called smurfing, where they get a group of individuals together to go to different, in a coordinated effort, go to different pharmacies and get enough ephedrine to cook meth. But the thing is, that's not a very efficient way to cook it. It barely is enough meth to supply the people who did the smurfing, so those people typically don't have enough left to sell. So the sales issue is really an international issue now. We have people getting ephedrine from Canada, so a lot of the people who do cook meth are either smurfing or they're getting it somehow from Canada or from Asia, the Pacific Rim. Mm-hmm. But the majority of it, according to the DEA and according to every local, state, and federal law enforcement person I've spoken to in the last 2 years, is they all say the same thing. The majority, possibly up to 80%, is coming from Mexico.
Oh, my goodness. We're going to have to break in just a minute, but can you give me a real short answer as to, is this is not just an American problem, isn't it? Is it worldwide, or is the United States a major user of meth?
The United States is the major user of meth. You will find meth in other countries, but the United States is the main market for methamphetamine.
That's really shocking that we are so wealthy and so stupid. We do need to break now for announcements, and we'll be right back in just a few minutes. Please stay tuned for more with Scott Thomas Anderson. Welcome back to Manzanita Voices. This is Linda Field, and today we're talking with Scott Thomas Anderson, crime reporter in Amador County, California, who has written a book called Shadow People, How Meth-Driven Crime is Eating at the Heart of Rural America. Scott, before we broke, we were talking about people who are addicted to meth and how they manufacture it. What does meth do to the human body?
Well, for a long time, there weren't very good studies. And it's only in the last couple of years that some major universities have released meaningful studies that would tell us that, particularly about what meth does to pregnancies and the human brain.
Oh.
Anyone who's been around meth or lived in a community with meth knows that it causes physical deformation over time to the users. I mean, people who will look one way 3 or 4 years later, you might not recognize them when you see them.
Bone structure?
Yeah, it can. Well, certainly teeth. There's a famous term called meth mouth, which is associated with hardcore meth use, where the user has very few teeth. The teeth they have are rotted, have huge holes in them. Their gum tissue has disease in it. You could get a dentist in here to describe it better. I actually have a lot of more detail in the book about it, but it can eat away at your facial structure in a sense. It certainly neutralizes certain natural fats and proteins that are in your skin, which is sort of like taking good soil and cracking it into, you know, desert mud. It has that effect on people. I know I grew up with certain people in this area who became meth addicts. I'd like to think they look about 30 or 40 years older than me right now, and they're the same age. So it has that outer effect. The inner effect is it makes people addicted to these incredible chemically induced energy highs, and then catastrophic feelings of depression as they come down off that high as the meth wears off. So it's valleys and peaks over and over in their lives. And a lot of time, I've talked to methamphetamine addicts who are pretty far along in their addiction. I saw one guy get arrested. He was living on a little rusty houseboat in Delta. He was trying to hold down his job. He'd lost his wife. Couldn't see his kids anymore. He had very not good prospects, and he got caught driving under the influence of meth by a very savvy officer who knows how to recognize that. And I asked him, because he started crying, he was going to lose his job, he was going to lose his vehicle, and he was going to have nothing but this little rusty houseboat that barely floats to live on.
Mm-hmm.
And given how upset he was, I asked him, if you're this upset, why do you keep using it?
Yeah.
And he said, why don't I just stop breathing?
Uh-huh.
And with tears in his eyes, he said, I honestly don't feel like I can get up out of my bed and move from this side of the room to that side of the room without it in my system.
My goodness. Well, I wonder, I would hope that since the government obviously wants to put a stop to meth use, I would think that they would launch a huge informational, educational campaign the way they do with cigarettes. And inform the public day after day, just hit us over and over again with photographs of what meth does to the body, lack of teeth, the old, you know, before and after picture of somebody. I would think that would help to keep people from getting into it in the first place.
That strategy has not been on the government's to-do list, but there are seven major there's seven statewide foundations that are doing exactly that. And they all started with one program called the Montana Meth Project.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very similar to what you're describing. And it's a public-private partnership, a nonprofit organization that brings private money from the business district who has a concern about the community they do business in and a concern about their employees. Those businesses donate money to this nonprofit, and community leaders, school teachers, state senators, various people with an interest all work together. But California doesn't have one of those programs. It's in seven states right now.
Is that why I haven't seen any of this?
Yes, California doesn't have it.
Oh, and we're the biggest, aren't we?
We're the worst state for meth.
We're the worst state. Oh, my goodness. Okay, well, you wrote this book because it started with you winning an award, the Robert Novak Journalism Fellowship in 2010. Would you tell us, our listeners, a little bit about that and the foundation that funds that and what that led to, how it resulted in you writing the book?
I found out in April of 2010 that I was being awarded the Robert Novak Journalism Fellowship. I was one of 10 reporters in the United States that year that was awarded it. I was flown to Washington, D.C. and given the award on the stage of the National Press Club.
Wow.
Which was a really incredible experience because I was on the same stage that Muhammad Ali and Theodore Roosevelt had stood on. So it was an experience I'll never forget.
Big honor.
Yeah. And I don't think anyone in the Central Gold Country knows why it happened. But it did.
I'm sure. I've read your work. I know why it happened.
So part of that fellowship, I was given a major grant to do a national journalism project. And because of what I was telling you earlier, the relationship between crime and victimization and methamphetamine addiction was the one story that the media hasn't been telling. And what I told the foundation I wanted to do, and I told them it was really the only thing I was interested in doing. The way I explained it to them is I said the media has a big problem when it comes to drug stories. They have a formula, whether it's a documentary film, whether it's Dateline or 2020, whether it's a National Geographic episode. they all use the same formula, and that is the journalist is going to talk about 80% about how the drug tears down the addict, and a little bit about ruining your family, and a little bit about maybe being in jail. But the entire formula these media outlets use when it comes to any drug, whether it's meth, heroin, crack, is how does the drug destroy the addict?
Oh, now, well, that's kind of what I was talking about before.
And yes, and now that's a that is a valuable form of reporting, but the problem is it's the only form of reporting when it comes to drugs in America. Even the Associated Press, who have been a little better about covering methamphetamine than any other sort of media entity, still typically have that formula as well. My experience as a crime reporter for 5 years was that was not the real story of meth in America. The real story of meth in America is victims, victims of crimes, that because the addiction drives the addicts to commit crimes, from burglary to larceny to check fraud to identity theft to spousal abuse to child abuse to elder abuse to homicide. And working here in Calaveras and Amador County, I can't think of one property crime that wasn't directly related to meth. So meth addiction. Maybe a couple burglaries that were related to OxyContin addiction, but
just
the majority
drug,
were meth is the common denominator in almost every crime story I covered in Amador and Calaveras for 5 or 6 years.
Wow.
So what I wanted to see was would that be true in other rural communities like this all across the country, and the foundation paid for that, made it happen.
So you spent, I think it was 16 months traveling around the country.
I spent 16 months embedded with rural county law enforcement agencies in Northern California and taking breaks for a couple weeks at a time to go to different rural communities in different parts of the country.
And what did you find out?
About which or both?
Well, about the rural communities in other states.
Yeah. Meth is driving crime in every rural community I visited and every rural community I contacted that I didn't visit. It's very similar to what I just described. Child abuse, domestic violence, property crimes, occasionally brutal homicides. A lot of these rural communities are struggling economically. A lot of them are struggling to hold on to whatever little industry they have, whatever few jobs they have. There's a culture of rural poverty in many of them, which breeds a culture of hopelessness in many of them. And that does, I think, play into the hunger for methamphetamine. But I don't also think that entirely explains it.
Yeah, it's too big a thing, I suppose, to entirely explain at all, especially in a one-hour show. But the people in the affected communities that you visited, were they generally aware of the problem? Or if they were not users, did they not really know too much about it?
The communities I went to seemed to have a high degree of public awareness. One of the places I wrote about in the book is a town called Miles City, Montana. And they had gone through 3 different incidents, which were like atoms bombs falling on the town, where they had to confront their meth problem. The last incident was the captain of their fire department was arrested for selling meth.
Oh, my goodness.
And that was in 2009. He pled guilty, by the way. So there was no way for a town like that. And it's not a bad town. You go there, it's a beautiful town. It's a high west version of Sonora or Jamestown or Jackson or someplace like that, Sutter Creek. It's a really nice place, and I liked it there. It's a great ranching community with really interesting cowboy folk who I got along with really well. It's not a bad place, but they have a meth problem, and there was no way for them to ignore it after the captain of their fire department was arrested for selling the drug.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think that degree of awareness was pretty consistent in the communities I went to.
Now, the book that you've written is your one of the reasons that I wanted to have you on the show today, and we are recording this kind of I just got hold of Scott last evening and said, I want to have you on the show, and we agreed to do the recording today. And usually when I record a show with a guest, the show might not be aired for 3 or 4 weeks. I'm going to try to get Scott's show on as soon as possible, because there's a very time-sensitive reason, and that has to do with his book. Would you please explain that for us?
Well, the book is coming out in February. It's being published by an alliance of nonprofit groups and a club of journalists, and we could talk more about the freedom to do real reporting that gave me, as opposed to going with a commercial publishing house, which I originally was doing, and I stopped. But what's going on now is it's coming out in February. There's separate from that, there's a Kickstarter fund that people can contribute to that gets them an advance copy for a really cheap price, and the fund pays for a bunch of free copies to go to nonprofit groups and victim advocacy groups. It also is going to keep the price of the book down on store shelves below $10 if it's funded, which is incredibly important to me because I want the people in these communities that I visited to be able to afford to buy this book if they want to read it. Mm-hmm. And I think folks in Amador and Calaveras understand what I'm saying when I say, in the current climate, there's a huge difference between $16 and $10.
Yes.
People are really struggling. I'm aware of that because I'm a reporter in a rural community. I know how bad people are struggling, and I know how scarce disposable income is, and I know how bad gas prices are hurting people. So the Kickstarter fund, if it's funded, will allow us to keep the book below $10. So essentially, people can go onto Kickstarter. They can pledge $10 into that fund. That buys them an advance copy with no shipping and handling.
Hmm.
They can pledge more for other rewards and get the book for free, too, if they want. But this fund drive is going on between now and, I believe, November 13th. I know it ends in mid-November, so we want to get it funded. We're at about 46% right now interview. So just want to let people know that if this is a book they want to read or they feel like they need to read, they can get an advance copy of it and help other folks out in the process.
They will actually get the copy in advance of the time that it comes out
officially
in February?
They'll be buying an advance copy. I'm sorry.
They'll get it later.
They'll be buying an advance copy, and it'll come out. It'll come to them in February when the book's released.
Okay. Mm. And this is so time sensitive because you have, I think it's a 60-day window to.
Yeah.
You've had to state a certain amount of money that you hope to raise.
That's how Kickstarter works.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, but maybe people aren't familiar with that. So on Kickstarter supports the arts, and you go to Kickstarter if you have an art project that you'd like some help with, and you state how much money you want to raise, and you get 60 days, you get to post your project on the website, you get 60 days to raise that money. If you fall short by even $100, then nobody who pledged the money has to come up with any of it. They don't get charged, right?
They don't get charged.
And you don't get the project just goes away. At least
I want to be real careful to make it clear. The book is coming out in February.
Good.
This is a special fund that's just specifically to keep the price down and to get copies to victims groups and nonprofits. So you're helping other folks out if you get your advance copy this way. But it doesn't mean the book is coming out in February.
The book
is definitely coming
out.
It'll be on Amazon. It'll be in bookstores.
But this is really such an important topic, and I know I myself am pretty ignorant about the whole meth question, and I bet a lot of people are, and I think that one of the ways that we can help to defeat the problem is to spread the word and educate the public, and your book can do that. So if you would like to help with this, please go to Kickstarter.com. And on the home page, you will see a link that lets you search a project, a specific project. You click on that, and you'll come to a second page where you can type in the search box, you can type in the title, Shadow People.
That pulls the page right up.
That will pull Scott's book information up, the page, all everything you need to know about it.
Typically, when you scroll through the category writing and publishing and the category journalism, typically it comes up that way too. But it kind of depends on how much online activity is going on with each project at the time.
Uh-huh.
So sometimes yes, sometimes no.
And how knowledgeable the person with the mouse is.
Yeah.
I had a little bit of trouble, but then I was also dealing with a computer that wasn't working right. Okay, so we do hope that that's the reason that the show is, that you're hearing it now, so soon after we're recording it, because we do have this time constraint. I'm hoping that a lot of you will go and pledge at least $10 to get $10 for a book. How many pages is this book? Do you know?
Well, they're still working on that, but it's about 48,000 words.
48,000 words, and it's going to be hardcover, paperback?
It's paperback.
Paperback.
Again, the whole object is to keep it affordable for rural communities.
Keep the cost down.
Yeah.
Yeah. Really important project. So, now, Scott, you mentioned domestic violence as being tied to meth. How common is it for meth to play a role in domestic violence?
Domestic violence is probably the most invisible character in the meth saga, but it's so prevalent. And the people that can tell you about how prevalent it is are victims' advocates. People like Operation Care, for example, and other organized victim advocacy groups.
Okay. Excuse me, Scott. I was so interested in what you were saying. We have gone way over on time, so we're going to have to break right now. We'll be back in just a moment. Please stay tuned. Welcome back to Manzanita Voices. We're talking with Scott Thomas Anderson about the methamphetamine craze in this country and what it's doing to us. And, Scott, you were talking about how it affects domestic violence, and I'm sure that that leads right into child abuse.
Well, yes. These are the two untold stories about meth. Meth's an untold story itself, but within that, they're the two big unknown entities to the public are domestic violence and child abuse. They're huge components of my book because they're so underreported in terms of the relationship between meth and addiction and this type of crime. With domestic violence, it's a couple things. One, there's a female meth addict who's in an abusive relationship. Her addiction is a form of control on the part of the abuser to keep her in that abusive relationship. A savvy abuser knows that he's got a victim that's so addicted to meth that she's probably not going to reach out for help, and he can use that addiction to his advantage in continuing to keep her in that situation. The other thing is meth causes violent and extremely unpredictable behavior. I've seen incredible acts of violence in the year and a half I've been doing embedded work with law enforcement where meth was the trigger. Either paranoia, some cases even hallucination on the part of the abuser. One victim told me that her boyfriend was seeing someone who wasn't even there and thought she was talking to him and broke her jaw. So that is the type of issue with domestic violence that victims' advocates and law enforcement and prosecutors are constantly dealing with. They don't talk about it a lot that much. It's common to them. It's every day. But the public needs to know. And they agree with that, by the way. They've been hugely supportive of getting that message out there. The other even bigger problem with meth addiction is child neglect and child abuse. It's the most tragic type of story I told in the book. And I told it, I think, in an unflinching, perhaps even brutal way, because I wanted readers to know what the reality is, what goes on in these meth houses and how these children are treated. They're innocent victims, and they're the real victims of the meth epidemic.
Without being too brutal or too graphic, could you give us an example of something that you've seen?
Children that haven't been fed for weeks at a time, are barely dressed, are living in sanitary conditions that we won't talk about on the show but are described in the book. In some cases, there's violence involved as well. typically it's crimes of omission where that child becomes invisible to their parent and the parent's no longer taking them to school, the parent's no longer feeding them, the parent's no longer making sure they have a safe place to be, that they have a safe environment. Sometimes it involves cooking meth around the kids. Mm. Sometimes it involves leaving small children where they can get a hold of bags of methamphetamine, which can be lethal. It can involve the risk of an explosion in the house. I actually wrote about a story that happened just this year in Georgia where a meth lab exploded and killed three small children.
Oh, my goodness. Then there's the pollution that goes on in the rivers and streams and the land around where these meth labs are.
Absolutely. It was a bigger problem prior to 2005. It's still a problem, though. The one sort of victory the federal government had in 2005 in passing all those regulations is domestic meth labs dropped by probably around 70% nationwide. So it was an environmental victory. But what they gave up was they gave the market over to the violent Mexican drug cartels, which in a lot of cases were more dangerous and more prone to violence than the original people who were cooking the meth prior to that. So, it was an environmental victory on one hand, but it was a geopolitical disaster on the other.
How much danger do you think? We've all heard about all the carnage and killings in Mexico with the drug cartel. How much danger do you think there is of that spreading across the border?
We don't know. It's a huge topic debate in law enforcement. It's one of the only sort of current events around methamphetamine that the media has been covering, but when you get into that subject, you're also talking about heroin and cocaine. You're talking about the whole concept of having a major exporter into the United States, which is a major market for all of these drugs.
Mm-hmm.
But how realistic that the level of violence that's happening in Mexico, which is at this point almost hard to comprehend, spreading into the United States. There are some anecdotal stories about kidnappings and violence like that happening in border cities along Texas and Arizona, but I'm not an expert on those, so I'm not sure. It's a scary thought, though.
Yeah, it is. Now, you spent some time in Arizona. That was one of the places where you went to visit.
No, Montana.
Oh, I'm sorry, Montana. Montana.
Montana, Nebraska, Iowa, Georgia, northern Minnesota.
Okay.
And I was barely in northern Minnesota. It was mostly Montana, Iowa, Nebraska, and Georgia.
Were the problems that you saw in all of those places pretty much interchangeable? It could be they were pretty much the same everywhere?
Yeah.
Or is there any place that has a unique problem?
No, the big question is where does the meth come from?
Yeah.
When you get into a place like Montana, and you're in Miles City, and there's not a real town for 2 hours in any direction, and you know it's very difficult to have a meth lab now, you are wondering who is the main supplier, because people are still getting arrested with meth and are still getting arrested for committing crimes under the influence of meth.
Mm-hmm.
And truckers are one answer to that question in Montana, where maybe truckers aren't really a huge part of the problem in Georgia. So that seems to be the question that differs in these communities, is what is the main route the meth is coming in from. But other than that, in terms of the types of crime and the way it's destroying people's lives, it's all the same.
Hmm. Now, your book is coming out in February, and just to review again for the people, Kickstarter.com is the way someone can go to the Kickstarter.com website and pledge a $10 pledge, and that will guarantee them that they'll get the book in February when it comes out, as long as your goal is met. And they will be not only getting the book at a very reasonable price for themselves, but they will be helping you so much in raising the money that you need to raise, your target goal, so that you can supply this book across the country in low economic areas where the problem is really so strong.
Make it affordable in those areas,
yeah,
and give free copies to victims groups and other nonprofits in those areas. Yeah.
So this is a very important thing to do. So, folks, I really do hope that you'll go to Kickstarter.com. Now, Scott, you also have your website, ScottThomasAnderson.com.
Mm-hmm.
Is that it?
Yeah.
And what will people find on your website?
There's links to stories I've written. There's a couple stories that are actually written into the website, big magazine features I did for Sierra Lodestar. Some of the links need to be changed because the Ledger Dispatch, which is where I do crime for, they just went to a new website. Some of the links have to be changed now. But the big magazine features are actually built onto my website. People can read those.
Yeah, and they're really interesting. I'll tell you, if you haven't seen the Sierra Lodestar, try to get a copy, and you'll have a treasure. The Sierra Lodestar is a paper that comes out once a week. It's free, and it has wonderful, wonderful reporting by a lot of journalists. And I was particularly taken by Scott's article called The Rivals. It appeared in August 25, 2010, and you wrote a really long article, so much information about the rivalries that existed here in Amador and Calaveras counties back in the Gold Rush time, and you highlighted especially the rivalries between two newspapers in Amador County that were both publishing during the Gold Rush and during Lincoln's time, during the Civil War. And do you want to tell a little bit about what that story was?
The current newspaper I'm a crime reporter for is the Amador Ledger Dispatch. That used to be two separate newspapers, the Amador Ledger and the Amador Dispatch. They were two separate newspapers all the way up until, I believe, 1992. So during the Civil War, the Amador Dispatch was pro-Confederate, and the Amador Ledger was pro-Union. And the Dispatch was violently pro-slavery, and while the Ledger was pretty staunchly in favor of emancipation and equal rights, and particularly supporting Abraham Lincoln. And the rivalry between the two newspapers is both shocking and hilarious, how personal and how bitter these reporters were about their relationship with each other.
And it resulted in when Lincoln was assassinated, the one newspaper gloated, the other one grieved, and it resulted in the two people who were at the head of the newspaper that was doing the gloating were arrested and made to march on foot from here to San Francisco, and they were imprisoned at Alcatraz. What was the reason that they were allowed to?
Treason.
Oh, treason. Okay.
Treason, because California was in the Union, and they had always published through the entire war articles and columns.
Okay. I'll tell you, it's a really interesting article. If you go to Scott's website, you'll see it. Also, in that article about the rivals, he talks about the rivalry between Mark Twain and Bret Hart, and that was fascinating. And finally, how a boy from Tuolumne County saved the city of Berkeley. So I really recommend, if you want to see the quality of writing that Scott Thomas Anderson does while you're waiting for your book, after you pledge for it, then go to his website and look up The Rivals. We have to break again. We'll be back very shortly with our final segment. Please stay tuned. Welcome back to Manzanita Voices. I'm your host, Linda Field. And before we get back to talking with Scott I do want to make an announcement about something that's going to be happening here in San Andreas. Well, not here, this, we're in Jackson, but in San Andreas on October 22nd. I'm not able to usually announce things that are coming up because the show is recorded at one time and aired much later, but this is going to be more immediate. So if you live in the Calaveras County, Amador County area, please check out Seeds, Stories, and Songs on Saturday, October 22nd from 11 to 3 o'clock in San Andreas. It's going to be at the Murray Creek Kitchen, which is a cute little restaurant right there on Highway 49, which in the town of San Andreas is called West St. Charles Street, 486 West St. Charles, by the way. But it's really actually Highway 49. Look for, we're going to have some balloons tied out there because the restaurant is set off down back from the road, and it's a little bit hard to see as you're driving by. It's just on the west side of San Andreas as you're coming into town from Occalamy Hill or Valley Springs. And we're going to have people reading their work, lots of poets and people with short stories reading. If you have something you've written and would like to come for open mic, come and sign up for that. We'll have people selling their books. And also, the seeds come in because there are going to be some people doing seed exchange there. So if you are a gardener and you have some favorite tomato seeds or cucumber seeds that you'd like to share and trade around with people, well, that'll be happening too. Also, we're going to be having some good musical entertainment. So it's a nice way to spend the day. That's Saturday, October 22nd, 11 to 3 at the Murray Creek Kitchen. And you can find out more about it by going to the Manzanita Press website. That's www.manzapress.com. And find out more about it and then contact me to sign up for it if you want to read or if you have a book to sell. Okay, back to Scott. Let's see. We need to talk some more about the meth story. And I didn't ask you very much about what it was like to be embedded with the law enforcement. So why don't you talk about that a little bit?
It was 16 months part-time. I think it's about 900 hours total between five law enforcement agencies primarily with a couple others, you know, to a lesser extent. I was embedded with, I'm still doing it right now, but it ends at the end of October as the epilogue for the book is finished and everything is sent off. But I've been embedded with the El Dorado County Sheriff's Department, the Amador County Sheriff's Office, the Calaveras County Sheriff's Department, the Jackson Police Department, and the Ione Police Department, with lesser time spent with the Tuolumne Unit of the California Highway Patrol.
Wow.
And the Oakley Police Department in Contra Costa County along the Delta, along
My
the
goodness.
Southern Delta.
That's
yeah.
a big area. You have seen a lot of
yeah.
stuff. Did you ever feel that you were in danger?
I was only in real danger maybe once in 16 months. There were other tense episodes, but I never really felt in danger, to be honest with you. I was working with professionals who are really good at what they do, and they're very cautious. California law enforcement officers are among the best trained law enforcement officers in the country, and here in the Gold Country, I can tell you that's especially true here. So I never really felt like there was a huge amount of risk. The liability was on them, and I can't tell you, it was an incredible act of bravery and transparency for those agencies to let me spend that kind of time with them over and over at night in patrol cars, in some cases on warrant searches, on probation sweeps, crime follow-up with detectives. I can't say enough about how much I appreciate them going out on a limb and trusting that they weren't going to get burned somehow by... They care about the problem like I care about the problem, and they know a reporter has the ability to do something they don't really have the ability to do, and that's be a voice for the people who don't have a voice, the victims.
Mm-hmm.
And they were willing to let me do that.
That really is good of them, because I can imagine they had somebody tagging along that they were responsible for, and they had a lot of other things on their mind. And we've had a lot of shootings in this area recently, and We all know that because of the economy, law enforcement is short-staffed and under a lot of pressure. And so I'm really grateful to them for letting you go along.
The one thing I hope people take away from this book, aside from all of the issues with methamphetamine, is that rural county law enforcement is not safer than big city law enforcement. It's a myth. It's actually the exact opposite. These departments are so understaffed because of their budgetary situations. And these officers often, and deputies, are often by themselves alone with extremely dangerous people. And it will take 10, 20, in some cases 40 minutes for another officer to get to their aid if they get in trouble. It is not safer than big city law enforcement. In big city law enforcement, an officer can typically get another officer to his aid within a minute to 2 minutes. I know of officers who have been in fights along the side of the road for 30 minutes by themselves. The people in the Gold Country, I really hope, appreciate what these men and women do for them.
Yeah, they really stick their necks out for us. It's the same thing with game wardens, too. I mean,
absolutely.
Such a huge area, such a huge area to cover. And maybe just one other person out there, or with game wardens, nobody else out there. Scott, before we close, I know we could go on and on about this because it's such a huge problem, and I really hope that this show will help you in your project with Kickstarter.com. I really hope that people will go there, pledge $10 at the minimum. Come on, you can come up with a little bit more than that because meth is affecting you in your area, wherever you are, and your kids are going to be affected.
And there's other rewards if you pledge more. It's, you know, there's a whole system of rewards for pledging more. So.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Do you want to talk a little bit about that?
Oh, well, a $15 pledge is a signed book. A $25 pledge is actually signed by one of the detectives who worked with me on the book.
Oh.
And it goes on and on. There's
Oh, nice.
A few people actually pledged $200 for an excerpt of the book that's not being published for legal reasons. So there's actually, I think three people have done that so far. So.
Oh, my, how wonderful. How wonderful. Well, that's good. Well, I certainly wish you well with that project.
Thank you.
If there's anything I can do in the future, I'll keep mentioning it here on the show.
Mm-hmm.
When is, again, the deadline of this Kickstarter?
It's mid-November, and as soon as you go to the page, it'll tell you the exact date.
Okay. All right. So we wish you well with that. Thank you for coming and sharing your story. It's terrifically important. And I think your book is going to make a difference. I really hope so.
Thank you for having me.
I hope that all of you will come back and hear us again next week at Manzanita Voices. I'm going to have another really great guest. And pretty soon you'll be able to go to a website and we will be archived and hallelujah, you will be able to choose to listen to any show at any time. But right now you still have to listen. It's 9:00 Sunday mornings, California time. That's noon back in New York State and wherever else. So I really thank you for listening. I'm beginning to hear more and more people contacting me saying they're listening to the show and enjoying it. And I hope that keeps up. I think we're performing a service here for writers, for people who love to read, and just getting general information out. So thank you so much for listening, and come back next week. This is Linda Field, Manzanita Voices. Have a great week.
You've been listening to Manzanita Voices, a production of the Manzanita Writers Press, an affiliate of the Calaveras County Arts Council.